It is 6 minutes past four, and this is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. Welcome to another edition of Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler, and we are going to go with our first guests of the day, Brandon McDuffie, who is a native of the Roaring Fork Valley, just completed a short film called Silverline Valentine, a cerebral romance of a short film. The film shows four times tonight at the launch pad as part of its First Friday festivities. And Brandon joins Express Yourself today. Welcome, Brandon.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us is the cinematographer for the project, Ian Morrison. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
And I remember you when you were about waist high to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were part of Youth Radio here at KDNK, weren't you?
Absolutely. Huh. We used to have a show on, Wednesdays or something.
Okay. And Brandon, were you part of Youth Radio also?
Unfortunately, I wasn't.
But you grew up in Carbondale.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. I'm from Missouri originally, but I've been here over 25 years. So.
How about that? Yeah. And the two of you met as clerks at Sounds Easy Video?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, be still my beating heart. This is just amazing to me. How is that what engendered your love for film?
Part of it, for sure. Definitely working there let me open some doors to watch some interesting films there, and definitely sprouted my filmmaker roots.
Mm-hmm. what films caught your eye and your ear?
That's an interesting question.
I was thinking the other day about how we used to play tapes and DVDs like at the counter when people would walk in.
Yeah,
I was thinking about that old animated Hobbit movie.
Yeah.
That's one that really resonates for me.
Yeah, for sure.
I dig that one out of the shelves. I just love the music in that.
Yeah.
Who was the music? I don't remember that one.
It's like some folksy score. It's good, but they have some really engaging animation too, kind of psychedelic almost.
Oh, interesting. And that predated Lord of the Rings and Hobbit and all that?
Yeah, before Peter Jackson got into it.
How about that?
It's good.
Wow. It was animated.
Yeah.
Oh, now that's pretty cool. Did he have all the adventures and everything else?
Yeah, it's like the whole story of the Hobbit, condensed.
Yeah, it's super condensed.
Yeah.
How about that? Well, Brandon, let's talk about, both of you. Let's talk about your new project. It's called Silverline Valentine.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck is a cerebral romance?
Well, basically, I adapted this story from my good friend Renee Cousineau. She wrote a short story. She's a fabulous writer. And she sent me some of her projects. And so when I read this one, it was originally called America's Most Wanted. And when she sent me this, it was really compelling, and it seemed just like almost a genre changer. And so basically I am trying to not give away basically a surprise ending that's at the end with the labeling it.
I know it's really tough to talk about, but
it kind of is. Yeah,
we don't want to spoil it because it's not only, it's definitely a surprise ending.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's sort of the philosophical point of the whole movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
But you went the whole nine yards. You did an Indiegogo campaign, which was successful.
Yeah. We reached our goal, and that was awesome. We actually went over our goal. And I was always in the past like hesitant on crowdfunding just because it's a personal passion project, and I was always weird about having other people pay for that dream to come true personally, but I just, I felt really strongly about it. And after the support of my friends, Jeremiah Hutchins and, Veronica Glass and Max Barbineau, who's the producer, Veronica's also a producer. After they just kind of I've been doing a lot of paid projects, with Jeremiah, just around here in the Valley. And I hadn't made my own short film since a film called New Broken Calculator back in 2010. So I just felt like it was finally time to maybe just spread the wings and do it. And so I needed some help with that. And I got it.
You had a complete cast and crew, didn't you?
Yeah. We have Sophie Saxon, who's actually from the Valley, kind of here. She graduated from Bridges, and Max knew her because he went to Bridges, and that's how we kind of connected with her. She's living out in LA right now, so it was kind of perfect because we were out there doing pre-production and we had her come and read, and she was fabulous. Yeah,
she did a beautiful job. Yeah, she really did.
Yeah, and she hooked us up with Robert Livingston, who is the other lead in the film, and they had done acting class together, so when they came and read for me, like, they just had chemistry right off the bat. And I knew, like, I didn't even hold that much of a casting. It was like pretty much like the two first people that came were just happened to be perfect, which was awesome.
Wow. So that made your job easy.
Yeah.
Did you do all the casting yourself?
Yeah. Me and Max and Veronica helped out a lot too.
Well, you have multiple credits. You're the writer, the director, the editor.
Yeah.
Casting director.
Yeah. It usually goes that way on a short film.
Sure, it does, of course. Yeah. Do you feel like this is a good calling card for what you think you can do?
I would like to think so, but it's interesting because a lot of my other projects kind of differentiate, like, a lot. You know, like the first one I ever did was an animation, like kind of a satirical animation. Then we made VHS PD, which was just kind of a straight comedy, and that was during film school. And then coming out of film school, I developed this script called New Broken Calculator that was kind of like a kind of a heart jerker drama. And then this one is kind of what it is. So I'm not said. my filmography doesn't really paint a clear picture on what I like to do. So.
Where did you guys go to film school? Did you both go to film school?
Yeah, we went to Colorado Film School.
Where is Denver. That? In Denver.
Well, it's kind of on the edge of Denver there, almost Aurora. But yeah, it was a good time there. We got a lot of technical background and met a lot of really good people, and yeah, it's a good time.
Yeah, it was.
Making good connections.
Yeah.
And exactly. Good work too. I think we had some pieces come out of there that I was very proud of. New Broken Calculator in particular, which we also shot on 16mm.
Yeah, that was really important for us. Actually had to fight a little bit to shoot on film, but yeah. It was a lot of fun,
you know, as a cinematographer. And I wonder if it was a little challenging because most of the all of the film takes place in a pretty confined space. Does that make things difficult for a cinematographer?
You know, it definitely is constricting. I think the typical Hollywood process would be to, you know, take that bus, chop it up into pieces, take the wheels off, you know, throw it in a studio, green screen, you know, all that whole setup. We actually shot on the road. We went down to New Mexico and shot this thing in the bus, which, you know, it was difficult for me. I think it was difficult for everybody concerned. Yeah, because we're all, you know, the whole crew was on the bus with the exception of a couple people, you know, in cars. So it was definitely a challenge, but I think we achieved our goals. Like, yeah. I really think that we've got our vision dialed in with this thing. That's what I'm the most proud of with it.
It's funny because we not only struggled during principal photography, but like when my audio guys, which I had really talented guys from Los Angeles, Tom Marks, and he basically told me, he's like, normally you would just put it on a process trailer and you wouldn't have the bus running. And he's like, that would make things a lot easier. And I was like, yeah, sorry about that. I was like, we kind of had to, you know, we were shooting, you could see out the window in a lot of the shots. And so I was like, we kind of need to, I can't afford to put a whole bus on a trailer and do that whole big production kind of thing.
Right.
I was lucky enough just to get the bus itself for a reasonable price.
And you found the bus in New Mexico, which is why you shot it there.
Yeah, my producer Max, he hunted down this guy called Casey Duncan, named Casey Duncan. He does a lot of the production vehicle stuff for New Mexico, worked on Breaking Bad and Hell or High Water, things like that. And so we called him up and had a conversation, and he was able to get us a bus for a really good price for 3 days. When we were looking for this stuff in LA, it was just insanely expensive per day. Yeah. Plus you have to hire a driver. We were able to get a guy that just owned the bus and drove it around and was in the movie. And it was really cool. New Mexico was an awesome place to shoot a movie. Yeah. Santa Fe, New Mexico is where we were, and we really enjoyed it. I probably will definitely be going back there for future projects.
Why did you like it? What was it that you liked?
It's just the scenery is so beautiful out there, and they're so welcoming to filmmaking because you know the market out there is there, but it's not. It's kind of slim, I would say. I don't know for a lot of like nothing like Atlanta or anything like that.
Yeah. It was a good time. I think there was a lot of good people down there too. And, you know, the people were welcoming to filmmaking too. And, you know, just really felt like it was the right place to be. And it looked like what we wanted. And, you know, to go back to the process aspect of shooting the bus on a stage, you know, seeing out the window, I think it became part of the movie, you know, like that the real feeling of being on a bus, which you might not know, it's pretty boring, but you get to see some beautiful things. So
right.
Well, that's part of the charm of the movie because everybody grinds it out when they ride the bus. You know, you see maybe some things that you don't really want to see or whatever, and yet here's this beautiful young couple who basically fall in love within 20 minutes,
right,
more or less, on the bus, right. On a long-haul bus trip, which is... And, you know, I want to compliment you on your writing. I don't know how much of it was lifted directly from the short story, but you know, when they first met and he thought she was an English major because she was reading a Hemingway book, and she thought he was a philosopher because of something.
Yeah, he just kind of had this philosophical line that she just kind of poked at him for.
Oh, that's what it was.
You know, like I was saying, the short story had a lot of internal dialogue with the female character.
Oh, okay.
And it was interesting trying to adapt it into a screenplay. And I remember Renee, when I sent her the first draft of my script, she said, "It's awesome." She's like, "But are you going to change anything?" and I just loved your writing so much. And I was like, "Oh, you're right. I kind of did just plagiarize you." I was like, "I should probably make it my own in some way."
So how did you express that internal monologue? Was it in gazes and physical actorly things?
Yeah, it's basically, and that's why you need good actors that can act with their face rather than just pure dialogue and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think we achieved that.
Yeah, I think you did too.
I really, really appreciate what they did for the film.
Well, before I let you gentlemen go, let's talk a little bit about what's happening tonight over at the Launchpad for First Friday. You're showing it four times?
That's correct. 6 o'clock, 6:30, 7 o'clock, and 7:30. I've been trying to urge people to get there kind of right on those times because it is only 15 minutes long, and, you know, people might come in the middle, and then they'll just completely be lost.
And then they'll be blown away.
Yeah.
See the ending.
Yeah, exactly. I want people to see it in its entirety, so trying to get people to be there on time. Not trying to be demanding, but, you know,
sure.
I to fully experience it.
Well, and it's a bit of a different, you know, sort of screening schedule. So,
right.
You know, come on down. We're doing multiple screenings, so if you do come in the middle, you know, you can catch the beginning
and
right,
see
exactly.
The whole movie.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And according to the materials I saw on the Carbondale Arts website, this is meant to raise a little money for you for the festival trailer.
Yeah, and I don't feel totally good about that, but because you know,
well,
you know, the crowdfunding,
I think you're being too modest, dude.
Probably
go for it, man. You got to find your audience, and there's people that are willing to help you do
I know
that.
And I really appreciate it. I just you know, people don't realize how expensive festivals can add up to. You know, some festivals might be $10 to submit. Some are even $100. So when you multiply that by 20, 30 festivals, it adds up quite a bit. And so I kind of just wanted to do an impromptu, like, spare change kind of, you know, if any little bit helps. And I'm also, I didn't mention this before, but I'm going through some music licensing issues right now. And there's some people that are working with me, and there's some people that aren't. You'd be surprised how expensive a 1940s song could be to license.
How about that?
Trying to sift through that.
So if you have to change things, you would do that in the editing room? How would you?
That's my
that?
Problem is I'm kind of just dead set on doing what I can to use the song because it's an important song to me.
Yeah.
I'm not only a fan of the song, but the song was there with me when I was writing the script. It was there with me when I was revising the script. There's times that I would read the ending with that song starting to play and just envisioning the ending exactly how I wanted it. And when I finally finished the film and got it exactly how I wanted it, it was such an amazing feeling, like getting it exactly how I wanted it. And so I'm really stubborn on using anything else, and I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that it stays in the film.
Including enduring us a round of fundraising
in
Carbondale, Colorado, among your friends and neighbors.
Yeah.
Hey, well, so what are your ideas? Taking it out on the road and putting it in, what festivals do you have your eye on?
Well, obviously, I've already submitted to Aspen Shorts Fest. I've had films in that festival in the past, and so I'm really hoping that we can get this one in there too. And then I kind of like Aspen Shorts Fest was my big boy I wanted to go after, and then I kind of wanted to just do a bunch of smaller festivals, just get it out there, get it exposed as much as I can. And yeah, we'll see.
Well, Brandon McDuffie, thank you for joining Express Yourself.
Thank you.
Ian Morrison, you too.
Yeah, thank you.
Good luck to both of you, and look forward to seeing more of your work down the road.
Thank you.
Awesome.
All right, stay with us. There is more to come on Express Yourself.
When you send me packing down in Green River Valley, I knew that if you couldn't, then no one would have me. Lost myself drinking with those stray dogs in the alleys till the whiskey sold my bones. Well, night it came on cold, blowing off that muddy river. I felt so goddamn old, I didn't have the strength to shiver. The moon swallowed whole, and when the sky slid back that sliver, I knew I had to go it alone. Love is free, so take all you can. Just don't ask me to be the bigger man. Yeah, 'cause I'm all spent. Well, I gave all I had.
Okay, that's a little taste of the Gasoline Lollipops. The Gasoline Lollipops play tonight over at the Temporary. Doors at 7, show at 8. It's a Denver band making their first visit to the Valley. Also tonight, both big shows up Valley, STS 9 at the Belly Up and Trombone Shorty at the Wheeler, are sold out. Elsewhere this first Friday, it's Pearl and Wood at the Carbondale Clay Center's special scholarship fund event at 201 A Main Street. Steve's Guitars has Bashville tonight. Marble Distillery features Josh Rogan. It's Confluence over at the Beer Works tonight, and at the Nugget right here in downtown Carbondale, it's the Union of None. That's five live acts tonight in downtown Carbondale. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. It shouldn't surprise me, but it does. It's just amazing. First Friday brings in the hordes, doesn't it? And of course, don't forget the parade, the Fat First Friday Parade, which will begin to gather right here in front of KD&K in about half an hour. And you say you're bored? Well, our next guest today is artist Doug Graybeal. Doug has a small pastel painting in this year's Valley Visual Arts Show, and I spoke to him last week about that and about his newfound art career. Things are pretty busy. Are they busy for you, Doug?
You know, they're comfortable.
Oh, so you're a sane person.
It took me many years to get here.
I know. That's a worthy goal. But what about that stereotype of the insane artist?
Having gone through the whole world of architecture, I'm trying to find that equal level there.
So we're not going to read anytime soon that you cut off your ear.
No. Maybe just a piece, but not the whole thing.
So do you believe in suffering for your art?
No, absolutely not.
No? It's all a joy? It's all...
If it's not a joy, then you're doing the wrong thing.
Okay. Yeah, but that's not to say that it's not a lot of work.
You know, at times it really can be. You know, I think as in any profession, you have your ups and downs and your good days and your bad days, and some ends in the circular file and some you hang on to.
What are your work habits? Well, we're talking to you because you're a painter, and you are in the Valley Visual Arts Show this year with a piece called Roaring Fork Valley Blues. What are your work habits? How are you painting every day?
You know, I try to paint every other day, and you know, I've got an actually pretty nice routine. I get up in the morning, go for a hike with my wife, come back, catch up on the world news, do a little weight training, and have lunch, and then try to spend, you know, 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon doing what I, you know, whatever irks me at that time.
So you're working in the studio? You're not working plein air?
You know, I work plein air when the weather is good. Yeah, I really prefer to be outdoors because you can really get a good sense on the light, what's going on. You know, pictures tend to block out a lot of what's going on in shadow areas and have a hard time balancing the light out. And it's so much more fun to be outside, but you also got to kind of get it down the first couple hours because the sun and the shadows and everything changes.
Okay. The piece in the show is pastels. Are you working exclusively in pastels?
Yeah, I started with watercolors and got intrigued with pastels due to my sister, who's an artist. She sent me a little set and said, here, try these. And I got fascinated with the fact that it's pure pigment. So you really get some good, bold colors out of it. So I've taken some workshops by some folks that are kind of grandfathers of the pastel world and started learning techniques of doing pastels with a watercolor under painting. So you take the pastel paper, do a watercolor underpainting, basically get your colors, your values, which are key, you know, getting the right values so you know what's dark, what's light, and then you can build on top of that, starting with your focal points and, you know, build out from there. It's a fun experience.
Now, when you're doing watercolor under pastels, are you talking details with watercolor, or are they just sort of background washes of color?
They're background washes. You don't try to get too much detail. You really try to get the value. So
I see.
You're familiar with the value scale. You go from black to white. So you're trying to get whatever maybe that gray tone, but you can do it in a pink, a blue, you know, a red, whatever. But you want to get the value correct, and then you come in and put your whatever level of detail you want on top. And it's nice to kind of put the detail in the focus, the focal point of the piece, and let everything else kind of blur out and edge. I don't think people realize that when they look at something, everything out in your peripheral vision is blurry. You know, so your eye and your mind tend to kind of fill in the details, and to be able to put the eye, draw the eye to what's important, the picture really adds and makes it pop.
Interesting. The piece in the show, Roaring Fork Valley Blues, is that such a piece with the watercolor underneath?
That one happens to be all pastel. So I was doing it on site and decided just to jump right into it because the light was changing and you know, working strictly in pastels on that one.
Okay.
You still can do the same thing. You can, you know, you basically go and lay it in pastel with your values, but you can then go in with your finger or a piece of pipe insulation and just rub it and blur and blend everything in. So you can achieve the same thing that you do with watercolor or any other media.
I see. But once it's down on the, I've never worked in pastels. Well, I've never really worked in oils either. I've played around with watercolor maybe just a little bit, but can you actually erase pastels? Can you paint over it, so to speak? How does that work?
You can go over it, depending on what surface you're working on. So there are pastel papers, which tend not to take a lot of pastel, and there's also a sanded surface, which is what I tend to use, a 400 grit paper. And on that, you can put, you know, 3, 4, 5 layers of pastel on top of that, and you'll hit a point where you won't hold the pastel anymore. And if that happens to you, you can take a fixative, and basically you're sealing everything that's underneath it, and it allows you to maybe put one more layer on top. And I try to avoid that and try to get it pretty much out the bat. It's one of the advantages of using watercolors, because it's watercolors being absorbed in the paper, so it's not as much of a hindrance to building layers of pastel up on top.
I see. Do you use a specific kind of paper?
I tend to use what's called a UART. That's a manufacturer for 100 grit. And okay. I try to either self-mounted or buy it mounted onto a board. So then when you're using like a watercolor surface on it, it doesn't tend to warp the paper. So you still end up with a flat, smooth surface to do your pastel on top.
That is artist Doug Grabeel, and unfortunately I'm going to have to cut away in order to do the rest of the show because we had a little bit of a technical problem at the beginning of the show. I'll have Doug's complete conversation up in about an hour on kdnk.org, so be sure to check it out there. I'll also have the other portions of today's show up and running there. Well, today's last guest is artist Lisa Singer. Lisa also has a piece in this year's Valley Visual Arts Show, as well as several pieces in a group show at the Red Brick Arts Center right now, with a couple more group shows coming up later in 2018. I spoke with Lisa last Tuesday to find out what's new with her work. You've gotten bigger with your paintings, in some cases quite large, like triptychs and diptychs and 5 feet by 4 feet.
Yeah.
Why did you go bigger?
I found that what I wanted to express really only fit in bigger areas, or maybe it would fit in a smaller area, but it was just more fun to make it bigger. Lots of texture, at the time when I was starting to work big, it was very stormy, so I was painting storms with objects in them. And so there was room in a large painting to do both those things, you know, to be very expressive with big strokes and everything, and then to have a place of calm and specific focus in the painting.
Mm-hmm.
I love that physical aspect of painting. You know, I don't just paint with a brush, but I go in with the sponges and with my hands and with sandpaper and, you know, palette knives and razor blades and things, and change things up in a lot of different ways.
Is that how you put those, I don't know if it's calligraphy or hieroglyphics that you sort of etch into the paint?
Right,
how
that's kind of my personal hieroglyphics. It symbolizes for me sort of like cosmic energy. But what I do is I lay down. Now, I'm telling the whole world here one of my basic secrets, so listen up, because it's gotten me pretty far here. But no, I lay down a layer of gesso, which is the underneath of the paint, and then I write into it with the end of a paintbrush. I literally go in and start doing my writing movement, which is a very kind of meditative, expressive feeling that feels like writing, feels like expressing energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a bit of a prologue to the laying down of the paint.
Right. It's sort kind of the opener for me for a painting.
Is there a direct link between the meaning of the painting and the hieroglyphics, or?
No.
No.
It's just the basic sense of energy that passes through all of us and through everything and all around us, just kind of bringing that to the canvas and as a starting place for the subject matter.
So, gesso, how long does it take gesso to dry?
Not long. Acrylic paint in this climate, I mean, of course, it depends how thick it is.
Uh-huh.
If I do something like that, generally I come back to it tomorrow. Whereas if it was, say, oil paint, I'd have to come back to it a couple months from now. But it takes, I don't know, about a day to you know, I can put several layers of gesso on in a day. Let's just say that. But when it's thick like that, I come back to it tomorrow.
And then you're layering paint on top of that.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember what we were talking about before. You asked me how long I've been painting. And I was saying that I started really getting serious about painting about 10 years ago. This is like my 10-year anniversary. And I think I showed for the first time at the Valley Visual, which for me, every time I bring a piece into the Valley Visual show at Carbondale Arts, I feel that sense of that tender sort of vulnerable beginning I had 10 years ago, putting my art up in public.
Uh-huh. That's the first big step for a lot of people.
Yeah.
For everybody, yeah. Really, isn't it?
Sure. Uh-huh.
That first showing, exhibition.
Showing somebody what you made.
Yeah.
Just like a kid, you know, just like a beginner. It's pretty wonderful that we have that opportunity right here in Carbondale.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're in a show right now, but it's not in Carbondale. Well, you have a piece in this year's Valley Visual.
I do. Yeah, that was fun.
Describe that one. I don't remember seeing that one. Tell me.
Right. That's a piece from my American Spirit series, and it's called Curtain Rising on the States. And it kind of goes to my feeling about, if you will, small government, like not necessarily grassroots, not like tiny government, but like smaller than federal. So I have this tender feeling for the United States, all of them, and how I feel that they should be governed individually and not dependent so much on federal, on handing down dictates from the federal government.
I see.
So that's a little piece on that. A little different from my usual thing.
So it's as if some greater being shook the flag off and the stars fell out, and now the stars are below that curtain of red and white.
Red and white, the stars, the stripes, and the stars beneath the stripes, and some of the stars are changing into butterflies, and it's a whole.
Oh, I didn't catch that, but you're right. Because, now that you mentioned that.
They're different colors.
They're not exactly stars.
They're starting to fly
starting
around.
To stretch out. I love that. So which states are starting to stretch out?
Well, that's up to the viewer.
Oh, okay. She doesn't want to go on record, in other words. But you have also some work at the Red Brick Art right now, right?
I do. I have three very large paintings at the Red Brick. They're very exciting. They're right there in the front entryway, and they got a great little spot. And I'm just so happy with those three paintings there.
Why?
Well, because probably they're the first largest paintings I've ever made, and I feel that they are successful, and they have a lot to say. People have a lot to say about them. They're well received, and I don't know. I think they're beautiful.
And this is Leaning Into the Light series?
That's the show. Leaning Into the Light is the name of the show up there.
Oh.
And there's many other artists that are up there. It's quite a great show.
Oh.
There's, I think, probably 6 to 8 other artists up there at the Red Brick right now. And it's just a wonderful show. I totally recommend it.
So it's not a new series of work for you. It's the name of the show that's happening.
Well, it happens to be a new series of work for me, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's
talk. The beginning of the next thing, which has kind of been like after the storm. I sort of had a big storm period, and then now I'm kind of having an after the storm period, sort of the feeling of after a storm has lifted, per se.
Uh-huh. Oh, so it's still part of the after the storm.
It is.
But it's also
leaning towards the light.
Towards the light. Does that have anything to do with lean in? You know, that that thing that's a thing right now.
Of leaning
especially
in.
For women. Leaning in.
You mean like the metaphor or the idea that you're really interested, so you lean in towards something?
I guess that's what that means, yes.
And you want to really hear what's being said and communicated. I think so, but, you know, I like the larger feeling of kind of psychologically and spiritually kind of, I don't know, walking on the sunny side, if you will, sort of leaning towards the light, you know, like leaning toward the light rather than, say, the darkness.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you went through all those dark clouds and storms, and now you're leading into the light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, those storm series, the storm series, really busy, tumultuous skies.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always a little part of it, whether it's the boat on the sea that is still floating,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's a windmill on the prairie that's still standing,
mm-hmm.
despite all of the turmoil around it.
That's right.
Is that kind of...
That's exactly it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't necessarily do all that on purpose. I kind of do what sort of I'm told to do, so to speak. I paint what comes to my head. And that seems to be what keeps coming, is like all this tumult and all this, kind of scary, sort of iffy circumstances. And then this sense of hope and this sense of light, if you will, and going on, you know, surviving, going on.
Well,
thriving, if you will.
On your website, lisasingerart.com, by the way, you have all these series right up there on your website, and the storm series, and people can go there and they can see these tumultuous skies, and the after the storm series, things have calmed down.
Yeah.
You know, the skies aren't as busy.
I'm feeling a lot of, right now I'm feeling in this after the storm period for me, I'm sort of feeling a lot of like coasting and lifting and sort of limbo feeling, like almost like the like how the mist rises up off the land after a storm, or I keep getting these images of things floating up. So that might be along the way here.
Well, you know, artists are always in the vanguard. They're usually first.
Right?
I can't say that the politicians and the policy wonks are there with you right now.
Well, you
they're
know,
they're still all
they
stuck
do more
in
art.
The turmoil. Exactly. Is that sort of your
That'd
point?
That'd be fun. I would say that all of my work is political in the sense that I have a feeling for the social condition around me. But it's not like a choice of this way or the other way. It's just an overall sense of the human condition and being here now, so to speak, in this climate.
Well,
social climate.
On your website, you list which paintings you've sold, and I counted at least 15 or 20.
Yeah,
there's probably more.
I've had an amazing time lately.
Have you? That's great. Congratulations. You worked hard for it, didn't you?
Yeah. That's the thing that strikes me. I did work hard, and that's the thing that strikes, you know, older folks who have been around a while, like me now, as it turns out, always say, you know, well, if you work hard, you know, you can get what you want or do what you want to do, or you can succeed. And that was always like, really, you know, a question in my mind, like, really, really, will I really get what I want if I work? And turns out I did, like 2 or 3 years ago, decide to stop teaching. Not that that's not work, but I just decided to really focus my energy on painting, not doing anything like mixed media or transfers or any of the fun stuff that goes on with different media and iPhones and photographs and things like that, and just really focus all my energy on painting the very best paintings I could paint. And I tell you, I was really surprised to be so vastly rewarded for my efforts.
Huh.
So hopefully that'll continue. Hopefully I can stay focused enough. And
so it's one of those overnight successes that lasted 10 years.
That took 10 years. People always ask me, how long did it take you to paint that painting? You know, that seems to be a very common question I get. And I can understand why people would wonder. And lately I've been saying it took me my whole life to paint that painting. Everything I did, you know, that's kind of... Yeah, that's kind of a weird answer. So then I say, well, it took me about 80 hours or something like that. But I don't just work on one piece at a time, so it's very hard to keep track of how much time actually goes into a painting.
Oh, you don't. That's interesting. Why do you make that choice when you work?
Well, it came out of a very practical thing of needing to let things dry and things like that. But also sometimes I'll paint and paint and paint, and then I'll stop and look and wait for the painting's not telling me what it needs yet. What's the next step? And I just kind of set it aside and keep looking at it until it talks to me. And in the meantime, I don't want to necessarily get on Facebook or, you know, listen to the news or anything like that. So I start another painting.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. Now, are you one of those artists that has their studio at home?
I do have a studio at home, but I still have my studio at the Third Street Center that I've had there since the very beginning of the Third Street Center. Thank God for the Third Street Center. That's all I have to say.
Why? Why?
Well, it's such a wonderful, it's always been such a wonderful place for me to work and get a little bit of social interaction and have a sense of being involved in the community, feeling what's going on, feeling the pulse that I was talking about of humanity as things come and go out of that building. And I just love my space there.
So why do you have a studio at home?
Well, you know, sometimes you find you want to work at home for one reason or another. I have two dogs. Uh-huh. Sometimes I want to be with them instead of leaving them for 4 or 7 or 12 hours at a time and go into paint. So I work in both places, yeah.
Right. Are you working 8 hours a day, baby?
Well, it's a funny thing. I generally, that's how I fill most of my day. I would say that I work from 4 to 10 hours a day on painting. I also love to do things. I have a greenhouse I work in. I grow vegetables and stuff. I find it very uplifting and inspiring to deal with the plants and the dirt and all that. It's funny because I've found that in a sense, gardening and painting are very similar in a way that it's a process of decision-making and discernment and pruning, putting in, taking out. It feels very similar to me. And they're my two favorite activities, growing things and painting, for sure. I spend a lot of hours painting.
Some upcoming shows people might want to be alerted to?
Oh, yeah. I'll be up at the Aspen Chapel Gallery in July with a landscape show, which for me generally turns into seascapes. I really keep trying to bring it to the Rocky Mountain, kind of mountainous sort of theme, but the ocean keeps happening. So we'll see what happens for that one. That's usually the landscape show up there in July at the Aspen Chapel Gallery is usually amazing, I think. So I'm part of that, and that'll be up for August, too. And then I also have a solo show at the Aspen Jewish Community Center this summer, where I'll have probably the size they are now, probably about 20 paintings.
I haven't been in that space. Is that right on the one right on Main Street?
Yeah, there? It is, with the menorah out front.
Yeah.
bicycles in the window.
What kind of space is that? I haven't seen it.
It's a lovely kind of lobby space, and then there's stairs up to a kind of a sanctuary and celebration type space up above. I'm just on the walls, like in the lobby, the stairway outside the sanctuary. There's a lot of big walls, and it's a nice space.
Cool. And are you venturing further abroad from the valley as far as
I'm not showing
galleries or
I'm
exhibitions?
Not showing anywhere outside of the I think that'll be my next step.
Huh, are you strategizing already?
Well, I'm gathering the energy behind it.
Okay.
Doing my homework, looking around, weighing it. Sometimes it's not always a great thing to be in a gallery, you know, but it's a give and a take. Uh-huh. So I'm weighing that and finding the right ones for me.
Are there galleries out there that you've been to that you wouldn't mind being in?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In Colorado.
There's a couple. Although, you know, you can't just say, I want to be in that gallery. It kind of has to be a good match for you, a sense that they need to, I think, have a feeling they want to and can sell your art, I think, is part of it. And that you kind of blend you fit in to their vision of their gallery. So.
Well, there are certainly plenty of inherent traps in that, aren't there? And I think most artists are acutely aware of them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's this big draw sometimes. You know, everyone always asks artists, what galleries are you in? Where do you show? And it's kind of hard to just say, I'm not in galleries. But on the other hand, it's okay, I think, to not being in galleries. And I like to be in shows, so I'll probably be pursuing that even harder than being in galleries per se. You know, to have a body of work that you have stashed miles and miles and miles away that you can't touch for a given amount of time, usually a long time, sort of hard for me. I like to be a little more flexible than that with my work. And I also think that it's gratifying for a buyer to buy from the artist. I think that it's more meaningful and it's more whole to get the story and the feeling from the artist as well. And also, I think it's more cost effective when you get right down to it.
So in that sense, a website is crucial.
Yeah. And you know, they say, that Instagram is the new gallery.
Uh-huh. So are you on Instagram?
I am, but of course I don't do enough of forward forwarding my art on Instagram.
Well, it seems like you're busy enough painting.
Yeah, right? It seems to take most of my time. It's a really good trick to market and paint.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that a formula you're still working on?
I am, and I get some help from my husband. He's taken an interest in sort of helping me do some marketing, which is great. It takes a little bit of the load off, so I'm more free to to paint.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
It seems like you're in a really good place, professionally, painterly.
Well, I'm right here in Carbondale. What could be better than that?
You got it. Lisa Singer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Luke.
Well, you only have 2 more weeks to see the Valley Visual Arts Show. It comes down 2 weeks from today. So as you circumambulate Carbondale tonight for First Friday, you ought to stop in at the launch pad. Of course, also at the launch pad today, tonight, in addition to the Valley Visual Arts Show, as you heard earlier, the local premiere of a local's new short film. So worth heading over there. And I should mention again that all of the segments of today's show will be up on kdnk.org if you missed any part of them. And, you know, Lisa's conversation was probably 35 or 40 minutes long. So much more content up there at kdnk.org. carbonfiberproject.org. And come on down and join the parade. It is gathering as we speak in front of Carbondale. I see a gorilla and a T-Rex and a psychedelic school bus and more than one pretty lady. So, you know, it's probably worth heading down to Carbondale and partake of First Friday. Let's go out with a little bit of music from Tony Furtado, who pays his semi-annual visit to Carbondale tomorrow night at Steve's Guitars. Thanks for tuning in, and please remember to go out there and express yourself.